Hello, and welcome to the Community IT Innovators Technology Topics Podcast, where we discuss nonprofit technology, cybersecurity, tech project implementation, strategic planning, and nonprofit IT careers. Find us at communityit.com.
Welcome to Jitasa University, where our goal is to empower nonprofits through free educational content. This month, we're featuring Matthew Eshelman, the Chief Technology Officer at Community IT Innovators. As a 100% employee-owned and managed outsourced IT services provider, they exclusively assist nonprofit organizations in utilizing technology to accomplish their missions and have been doing so for over 20 years. Let's pass things over to Matt and Carolyn and get started with the content.
Thank you so much for that introduction. So I wanted to go over our learning objectives for today. We want to make sure that we understand the cybersecurity landscape for nonprofits. We are going to talk about wire fraud red flags and common hacks and scams. And we also want to make sure that we learn the basic steps in cybersecurity and financial fraud prevention. So Matt.
Great, Carolyn. Thank you for that introduction about what we're going to learn today. My name is Matthew Eshelman. I'm the Chief Technology Officer at Community IT. We're a managed services provider that provides IT support to over 200 nonprofit organizations and about 7,000 endpoints. And so the information that I'm going to be talking about today is really informed by that base of clients that we're supporting and the insights that we gain related to the cyber threats that we're seeing across our clients, which are primarily small to mid-sized nonprofit organizations. And the landscape, it really is, lots and lots of automated attacks, against an organization's digital identity, also endpoints, and lots of email threats in there. Some trends that we are seeing is that account compromises, that's when a threat actor would get access to somebody's account. And not only their work accounts, but we're also seeing personal accounts associated with individuals being targeted as well. And then finally, device compromises, does seem to be ticking up as well. So while the primary focus of threat actors really does tend to be on an individual's identity, device attacks are kind of also common as well. And, the final piece, which is maybe the most common, is really email-based attacks. So those are those, messages that you get that look like they might be coming from your executive director or finance person. Those are really common and a very kind of cheap and easy way for threat actors to try to perpetuate what is fundamentally cybercrime, and it's financially motivated. On the operational side, some things that we are really seeing is that the cyber controls are coming from that the COO or the CFO side. And so those requirements are driving a lot of adoption of cybersecurity controls, particularly as cyber liability insurance premiums continue to go up. The underwriting restrictions become more stringent, and the controls that they're asking to be implemented also become more strict. So whereas, 5 or 6 years ago, basically didn't have any requirements in place, now organizations are really expected to have multi-factor authentication. They're expected to have training programs in place. They're expected to have endpoint detection and response tools, and maybe even required to have pen testing. All of these requirements are really driven kind of from the compliance side and from the cyber liability insurance side. We're also, the good news is that we're seeing that, those fundamental controls are kind of easier and cheaper to obtain now. And so for organizations, it's not a huge reach to implement those basic cybersecurity controls to keep them safe as an organization. And I would say the other things operationally that we are seeing is that we're kind of now firmly in, I think, a kind of a post-COVID era, but a lot of the things that impacted our work as part of, this COVID and work from home phase have really not shifted back. So while some organizations are returning to office in a hybrid model, many organizations are, not getting 100% compliance on that. So there's still a lot of remote work happening, a lot of flexible work policies in place. And so what we're seeing is that the organizations are really a little bit late to adopt the policies and procedures in order to make sure that their policy guidance is aligning with how their work style is actually occurring. And then finally, I would say the operational trends that we're noticing is that, you know, wire fraud or kind of financial fraud perpetuated over an electronic method continues to increase. And so while things like ransomware tend to grab the headlines whenever we're looking at the news, what we're seeing impact small to mid-sized nonprofits who have largely moved to the cloud is that they are being targeted by primarily email-based campaigns that are, at the end of the day, having successful wire transfers out to external parties that aren't who they say they are. And again, it's a lot easier for a threat actor to ask to wire money and for that to happen than it is for them to, you know, write some sophisticated malware, get you to install that on your computer, have it encrypt files on the network, have you go through and find some cryptocurrency and then do a transfer. And so it's just a lot more efficient for criminals to say, hey, can you give me money, or trick you into giving them money, and then having that financial transaction occur right away. On the technical side, spear phishing or spoofing, targeting personal accounts, home networks, social accounts, that's something we've seen in the last year or so that we hadn't seen before. And so I think it's good for organizations just to understand that, cyber criminals don't respect that work and personal life boundary, especially if individuals in your organization are using personal accounts as backup accounts for maybe social media or other online tools. That can actually be a threat to the organization if while maybe your organizational account has multi-factor authentication, the personal account may not. And so that represents a softer target for the threat actor to attack. We also kind of noticed that finance teams are more vulnerable to fraud whenever they're working remotely. We don't have that same degree of human connection or interaction. You can't, maybe just pop into your colleague's office and say, hey, does this look strange? Or did you make this payment change request? So it's important for particularly for the finance departments to follow those established processes and procedures whenever making payment changes or confirming information, because it's more difficult whenever we don't have that personal connection. We are also starting to see, AI is certainly the big buzzword, and we're able to leverage that for protections against cyber criminals, but it's also something that cyber criminals are using to make those emails more sophisticated, more accurate. So just as maybe a nonprofit organization might be using AI to help them jumpstart their fundraising letters to get more clicks, the bad guys are doing the same thing in order to get us to click on messages that might be malicious or trick us into giving away passwords. So some of the old adages that we may have relied on in terms of poorly worded emails being a trigger to not click on them, we have to be a lot more critical when we're evaluating those messages now. Kind of on the positive side, though, we are seeing lots of great tools and technologies in place to help support and protect remote workers. Many of the systems, or all the systems that we're using to support those 7,000 endpoints, are cloud managed and cloud centric. So it doesn't matter if an end user is in their office or working from home or working from the coffee shop, we can ensure that their device is up to date, that they're secure. If there's any issues, we're alerted about it. So again, there's lots of great tools in place to protect staff no matter where they're working. And then finally, I would say, organizations need to continue to work at those policies, related to acceptable use. I think particularly around bring your own device. I think at the beginning of COVID, it was a little bit of a free for all. Any device you had to get your work done, that was okay. But now I think organizations are realizing the potential impact of that when you maybe have a staff member who's syncing an organization's, all their files on their personal computer. Then that person leaves the organization, and now we have a situation where all of an organization's files are on a device that they don't control. So again, I think working through some of these policy questions reflective of the new work environment that we're in is a really helpful exercise for organizations to go through to make sure that they have a good accounting for all of their data, where it lives, who has access to it, and how that's going to be handled. Whenever we talk about specifically about financial cybersecurity, we kind of ask the question here, does your nonprofit do any of these things? Do you process donations? Do you have event registration? Do you store any personal information? Do you collect any information about your donors, newsletter subscribers? Do you pay vendors online? I think every organization does one or maybe all of these things. And so I think what I hope people realize is that every organization is a target. It doesn't matter the type of work that you're in. The threat actors don't really care about you or your organization or kind of what you do operationally. This is a cyber criminal enterprise, fundamentally motivated by money. You know, we kind of maybe have a stereotypical view of a hacker, you know, kind of in their parents' basement, you know, just kind of doing things to cause mayhem. But the reality is a lot of the cyber crime is driven by finances. And so if they can, you know, get $600 for gift cards, that's great. If they can get $10,000 for a wire transfer, that's great. If they can get $300,000 for a wire transfer, even better. And so again, understanding that a lot of this crime is financially motivated, and it's not really concerned about your organization, the mission, the great work that you do, I think it's helpful to, you know, provide some grounding into ensuring that all organizations are implementing good cybersecurity controls to help protect their financial assets. Most of the threats that we are actually seeing that kind of directly relate to financial crime start out as emails. They could be as basic as what we see here, which is a common request, and I'm sure many folks have seen. Hey, Tim, I want to know if you can process a wire transfer today. Let me know so I can send you the bank details. Regards, Tom. Again, this is often targeted at people in the finance department as a way to, you know, start or initiate a conversation. There are often elements of spoofing the sender's name. So again, you may get an email with the display name that looks like it came from somebody in your organization. Upon further examination, about looking at the reply to address, may highlight that it is not indeed from your organization, but that information has been spoofed. But what we're also seeing is that, you know, you could be interacting with an account at a partner that may have had an account compromise. And so while the email address itself is legitimate, the person that you're actually communicating with is not who's sending, not who you think is sending the message. A lot of fraud really starts off as an email and, you know, kind of continues on from there. So that's why you need to be very careful whenever you're evaluating those links, taking those next steps, because the person that you're communicating with may not be who you think it is. So in terms of how to protect and or how to prevent and detect those financial scams, I think it's important to just, you know, start with a healthy dose of skepticism. You know, if you're getting a request to update payment information or buy gift cards, it's a good, you know, good time to ask why. Is this something our organization would do? What does our organization's policy say about making payments or changing or buying gift cards or changing banking information? What do our pre-established policies guide us into? The second step here is just insist on processes to verify that information changes. I would say that no payment information should be initiated solely on the basis of an email communication. There should be perhaps a phone call to the person requesting the change from a number that you've already established. Because in the case of interacting with a compromised account, what we've seen is that the hackers themselves will happily provide phone numbers for you to call them on as a way to verify the transaction. So it's important to have pre-established numbers for people that you're interacting with so that if there is a request to make a payment change, you have a good known number that you can call that person back in order to make that payment change transfer. It's also important to just review and don't click on the links that are in the message. Again, if there's banking information, again, that could be malicious or spoofed. If there's ever any question, you can go to the website that you are intending to go to confirm that it's the correct site as opposed to clicking on a link, which again, might be spoofed or may redirect you to a site that looks similar but isn't actually a trusted location. We keep going back to the topic of email, but again, look carefully at the email address. While it is very easy to fake the from name, so again, you can change the from field to basically whatever you want, but it's very difficult to change the reply to address. So if you're unsure of who a message is from, if you simply click on reply, then you'll be able to actually see both the display name and the reply to email address, and that can often give some clues that as to who is actually sending the message. So again, they may look like it's coming from your executive director, but the reply to address could be something like a generic Gmail account. So using that as a visual cue just to make sure you know who you're replying to is an important step to ensuring the integrity of your communications. And then finally, just wanted to reinforce that, you know, always follow those internal best practices. Don't use workarounds. You know, as it's often said, you know, it's never the crime, it's the cover up. And so again, following established procedures and policies helps to protect you. It helps to protect your organization to make sure that, you know, all of those established processes and procedures that have been created to, you know, help the organization are still in place and still being followed. So at Community IT, fundamentally, we want to start with security policy. It's a great way for the organization to really get on the same page in terms of what are the organization's expectations around how data should be handled, how are we going to handle personal devices, what information do we have as an organization, who needs to have access to that. All of that can help provide a foundation for maybe making purchasing decisions or, you know, making other decisions later on. Building on that, I think it's important to invest in your people through security awareness training. I'm a tech person. I love all the, you know, the whiz bang toys and all the cool AI tech. That's all great, but, you know, fundamentally we're dealing with people. And if a person can kind of get tricked into updating some wire transfer information that they shouldn't, you know, that can all be done regardless of how many technology tools are in place. So again, security awareness training is an effective way of educating and training your staff so that they don't fall prey to these schemes. And then you can build, you know, lots of different technology tools and solutions on top of that. We typically think of that in areas of identity, data, the devices you have, the network perimeter, and your web resources as well. And then finally, once you've got all those things in place, you know, then you may be ready for, you know, some more predictive intelligence or some AI-driven tools that can provide some kind of next level protections. But it's important to start with the foundations and build up from there. I wanted to highlight some of the resources that are available and capabilities that are available from Community IT. As I said in the beginning, Community IT provides IT services to over 200 nonprofit organizations. So if you're looking for some additional help, we can provide assistance through some NIST-based security surveys. We also have a variety of assessment methodologies and plans that we can work with for organizations to help understand their gaps in their protections. And then, you know, provide ongoing managed services as a way to make sure that those protections are in place so that your organization is covered from a range of the different threats that are out there.
Awesome, Matthew. Thank you so much for that really helpful content. A couple of things that I thought of as questions along the way as you were presenting. One was around policies and whether or not you all recommend or if it's even possible to include within the policies that staff members include multi-factor authentication with their personal accounts. I feel like that'd be easy to ask, but hard to regulate. So how do you guys all stand on that as an option?
Yeah, I think, you know, you can ask for a lot in policies. And as you said, it can be easy to ask, but hard to regulate. But we've certainly seen organizations, particularly with heightened security risks, extend out training to, you know, partners of the organization. We've seen them extend, you know, antivirus protection to personal devices as a way of just elevating cybersecurity. And then I think, you know, asking for multi-factor authentication by policy, not only for work accounts, but also personal accounts is, you know, well within an organization's, you know, right to do. And I think it certainly makes a lot of sense understanding that, you know, the bad guys aren't just, you know, observing that work personal boundary.
Yeah, awesome. Thank you for that tidbit. Another thing that I was thinking through was whether or not you guys have a recommended frequency or some locations or resources for that ongoing training aspect and education aspect around security awareness.
Yeah, so at Community IT, we have a well-developed security awareness training practice. And our standard practice really revolves around quarterly trainings of staff I find it much more effective whenever staff are engaged in trainings more frequently, but of a shorter duration. So our standard approach would be, quarterly trainings of about 15 minutes using online resources. We're a KnowBe4 partner, and so, we have a run over all our clients through that. And so we combine the quarterly trainings along with monthly test phishings, just to kind of gauge progress over time, identify any users that might need additional training or reinforcement, and just to keep people on their toes. Security is not something that you can just do once a year. It's something that really needs to be part of the organizational culture, and it's something that really needs to come from executive leadership, right? Cybersecurity is something everybody needs to participate in. It's not something for, just the new people or just one department or the other. It's really something that the organization needs to make a priority.
And then my last question surrounds whether or not there are any recent tools that you all have found that you would recommend people take a look at. Obviously, people should come to Community IT as well, because you have your own set of tools. But is there anything else out there that you would, or anywhere else out there, you would direct people for some short and easy tools, such as, like, are there browser attachments within Chrome that people should download to protect themselves, or anything like that?
Yeah, I think a good resource, apart from Community IT's own website, which, has a lot of security resources, would actually be a resource called Stay Safe Online. So that's actually a federal government resource that is geared towards, small and mid-sized businesses as a way to give them, some kind of foundational recommendations for cybersecurity. They have some basic training resources as well. So if an organization maybe isn't quite ready to take on, a fully managed training program, there's lots of free resources there that organizations can take to get started.
Amazing. Well, thank you for that. Well, that's all the questions that I have. That was the short list. Thank you, Matthew, and thank you, Carolyn, so much for the time today. And we look forward to having you back again sometime.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you.
We hope you took away some valuable information on how you can protect yourself and your organization from cyber attacks. If you had a question for Matt that didn't get answered, feel free to email him at cybersecurity@communityit.com or schedule a one-on-one meeting with him. Thanks again, and we will see you next time.
Community IT does these free webinars and podcasts for our community, and we love sharing our knowledge and experience. If you have more questions or are having trouble with your IT at your nonprofit, please get in touch with us on our website, www.communityit.com, so we can start a conversation or schedule an assessment. Downloading any of our free resources there will get you signed up for our webinar reminders, and you can attend our next webinar in real time and ask our experts your own questions. If you love podcasts, please subscribe and leave us a rating to help others find this leadership resource for nonprofits.